Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins.
Wintertime winds blow cold this season. Falling in love, I'm hoping to be. Wind is so cold, is that the reason? Keeping you warm, your hands touching me.
The Doors singing about winter and love, and that reminds us that there's more to the season than just winter woes, the transportation trip-ups, and parking madness. We've talked this week on Radio Boston about how the early settlers survived in the dark days of winter. One of the ways they got through and kept their sanity intact was to hunker down and tell stories. We can do that. So if you're thinking of hunkering down this coming weekend, maybe to binge on House of Cards, think as well about binging on some great winter reads. Listeners, we'd like you to go to our Facebook page or tell us on Twitter, we're at Radio Boston, what your recommendations are for a great winter read. And by the way, try not to make it about escapism, or if we're talking about winter, we want to feel it on the page and hear it on the page. Again, post at Radio Boston or go to radioboston.org. With us now in the studio to talk about some winter works is Lisa New, professor of American literature at Harvard University. She's the author of The Lion's Eye, Poetic Experience, American Sight. Professor New, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks so much.
And joining us by telephone is Massachusetts writer James Scott. His new novel is called The Kept, which tells the story of a midwife living on a snowy, isolated farm. James, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So for both of you, what makes a good winter read, Lisa?
I like a winter read that helps us experience winter more vividly and vibrantly. Helps
us really get into it.
Really get into it.
And James?
Yeah, same thing. I mean, it's sort of the opposite of a beach read. It's something you can really sink your teeth into, poetic natural descriptions and language that you can sink into and get lost in.
Okay, good. You're going to help us get lost then. Lisa New, we may be so over the environment that surrounds us right now. It's lost its charm, I think, for a lot of people who have to negotiate it with every day. Henry David Thoreau, on the other hand, seemed to revel in his surroundings in that little cabin in Walden Woods. In Walden, he describes the morning after a big snowstorm when the train from Concord to Fitchburg is still running, which is a nice contrast to these recent times. You're a fan of that one, too.
I am a fan of Walden. You raise a really interesting and funny passage, since there Thoreau tells us that the trains will run no matter what, and that the snow doesn't stop the trains. I love, there's a moment in Henry David Thoreau's chapter called The Pond in Winter that really, to me, epitomizes the best winter writing. In that passage, Thoreau digs down under some feet of snow and bores his way through the ice for water. And he cuts into the ice a hole just large enough that he can, and this is what he says, he can look into the parlor of the fishes. And what I love about that, and why for me it's so kind of quintessentially, especially New England winter writing, is that for Thoreau, winter gives us a whole new perspective on what on the landscape we live in. He says there are also, heaven is under our feet as well as above our heads.
And you know what's great? You can see exactly that if you go there now. I mean, presumably the landscape would be the same as it was with him then.
Absolutely. And you can climb up the slippery, snowy bank and wait for the train and hope that it will be bellowing away.
Let's hope.
The way
yes.
It did for him.
But if you look into the parlor of the fish, just be very careful out there. James Scott, let's talk for a minute about your novel. Just out in paperback,
sure.
We should say, The Kept, takes place in the late 1800s in a frozen, cold, wintry upstate New York. What did you get your inspiration from?
I got my inspiration from growing up in New England and from visiting my grandparents who lived in upstate New York. The lake effect snows there. Coming off Lake Erie, just these, you know, low slate gray clouds, and the way the snow would just come in so violently and quickly. And then just the idea of, yeah, hunkering down with books and being warm and safe in the house, and thinking of what would be the opposite of that. And
hence your book.
Inherent.
And briefly tell us about the book, The Kept.
Sure. So it's set in 1897 in upstate New York, and a midwife, Elspeth Howell, returns home to find that her family has been murdered, all except for one of her children, her son, Caleb, who's 12, and the two of them set out in search of the men who are responsible.
Which leads me to ask, does writing with a winter setting, and I'm thinking actually of a film now as well, The Shining, all of which happens, Jack Nicholson's antics against the backdrop of a fierce winter storm, does anything good come out in characters in the wintertime? Because, James, it sounds like your characters are maybe inspired in the wrong way.
Well, to some extent. I mean, winter pushes us all, as anyone who's tried to park in the last couple of weeks, winter pushes us all to the brink of something, whatever it is. And sometimes those are very dark emotions, but they can also be great strengths. And I think that Elspeth has been pushed in the wrong direction, but it also is giving her an opportunity to atone for those things and finding strength within this landscape that's testing her.
That's your character in The Kept.
So much winter literature reminds us of how dependent we are on tools. It takes us in a way back to our primeval selves, where we mastered the environment by creating tools. One thinks of Jack London's To Light a Fire.
Okay,
where
you speak of that. You're not the only one, actually. Even before you did, Professor, one of our producers, Jamie Bologna, was mentioning this. He, in fact, is producing this very segment. He's so hot on
hot.
yes, on that short story, To Build a Fire, by Jack London, that we asked him, actually, if he would come in from the control room where he is right now and bring a copy, which I can see it's in his hand right now, of the short story, To Build a Fire. He's not going to read the whole thing, Jamie, because I know you've got other work to do besides
this. Thanks for having me.
There you are. Good. Okay, so give us first the reason why you love this so much.
Sure. Well, just a little background. The character in this story, who's never named, is a newcomer to the Yukon. And it's, for me, it signifies the sort of fierce independence of youthhood. He treks out into the woods in search of trees that seem to be good for logging in weather that's 50 degrees below zero. So this is a little section that stood out to me.
Great.
50 degrees below zero meant 80-odd degrees of frost. Such fact impressed him as being cold and uncomfortable, but that was all. It didn't lead him to meditate upon his frailty as a creature of temperature, and upon man's frailty in general, able only to live within certain narrow limits of heat and cold. And from there on, it didn't lead him to the conjectural field of immortality and the man's place in universe. 50 degrees below zero stood for a bite of frost that hurt, and that must be guarded against by the use of mittens, ear flaps, warm moccasins, and thick socks. 50 degrees below zero was to him just precisely 50 degrees below zero. That there should be anything more of it than that was a thought that never entered his head. And really, the only thing that ever entered his head was that he had to get back to camp by 6 o'clock for dinner. And so for me, this story is about the failures of self-reliance, the sort of blind hope of young people, and maybe even young people's over-reliance on modern technology at the risk of perhaps misunderstanding the harshness of nature.
Thank you, Jamie. Now I know
thanks.
You have to go back into the control room, so thanks for coming in. But it's also interesting because, as you were saying, Professor, this gets to the idea of using tools for nature or even against nature.
Well, I think Jack London's story and so much of the literature of winter, including a poem like, say, Wallace Stevens' The Snowman, asks us what good does it do us to think existentially? Jack London's story features a character who's kind of a mechanical, he's quite mechanical and not very thoughtful. And in that story, we are given to think, gosh, maybe if he'd had a little more existential respect for the elements and meditated a little bit more on his essential vulnerability, that would do him some good.
Right.
On the other hand, he gets pretty far in the story by detaching himself from that vulnerability.
I think also, James, it seems like what Jack London is saying there is that winter gives us a chance to test our mettle, and very often we want to take it on. We want to take on the challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this Yeah, as Jamie was saying, this guy is just trying to get to the boys. I love how he keeps referring to them as the boys. It seems like such a, you know, it seems almost silly, and his constant underestimating of what the actual temperature is. And my favorite scene in there is where he's watching the dog that's along with him. He's watching it as Professor New was saying, in this sort of mechanical way, as the dog is digging the ice out of its paws. And he's sort of, you know, looking at this without really thinking about it, but it's just such an automatic reaction to the dog, and here he is going against all of that.
And he, in a way, has to learn how to, he tries to dig the ice out of his paws.
Exactly.
And that is what's required, but also an instinct that the dog probably has more of than he does.
This makes me think also, James Scott, about Walking Out, which I know is a piece that you really love.
Oh, yes. This is one of my favorite short stories of all time. David Quammen's Walking Out. He writes a lot of nonfiction now, but this short story is just a masterpiece in my mind. And it's set, again, in wintertime, and it's a father who picks up his sort of estranged son to take him hunting. And this is not something the son would ordinarily be interested in. And the line that always just gets me amidst all these unbelievable descriptions of nature and all the sort of harsh beauty of it is actually a line of dialogue. And the father says, "And someday you'll have a son, and you'll be 40 years older than him, and you'll want so badly for him to know who you are that you could cry." And that's the emotional centerpiece of the story. And if that doesn't make you want to, you know, call your father or call your son, I don't really know what's wrong with you. But it's just such an amazing sentiment. It's relatively early in the story, and that's sort of the emotional question the story's asking of us, is whether these two can grow to know one another in these incredible circumstances.
I had never read that story until I got it last night for today, James, and I feel we should share that it includes a boy carrying his father 8 miles
yes.
on his back after the father has received a gunshot and after the boy has had half of his hand chewed off
right.
by yes. a bear. And in that story, the son does draw on resources of, you know, really heroic resources, and also just on his sheer technical, machine-like physical capacity to eventually at least get himself out of the woods. I think I have given away a lot of this.
There's a lot of spoilers in there.
A lot of spoiler alerts.
But yet, if listeners still want to read it, do.
Oh, it's great.
It's Walking Out by David Quammen, which is Quammen. We're getting some recommendations online, by the way. Let's see. We've got some Twitter input. Mona S. on Twitter says she recommends this piece of music, Schubert's Die Winterreise. Peninsula Apartments on Twitter says anything by Jack London signifies winter to us. Kate M. on Twitter says, The Siege by Helen Dunmore. That's about the Nazi siege on Leningrad. Okay, in the closing time, maybe just over a minute or so that we have left, give us a few more recommendations, Lisa New.
Well, I would really recommend Emily Dickinson's poem, It Sifts from Leaden Sieves. And I think I could even read a few stanzas of that poem, and you'll see why I like it so much. Like that passage from Thoreau where he looks into the parlor of the fishes, there's a way in this poem that winter visually transforms our familiar world, and that is, well, a week ago, what we liked about it. There's a roly-poliness about the shape of the world and all of the ordinary textures and colors we look at have been effaced. So here are a few stanzas of this poem, It Sifts from Leaden Sieves. It sifts from leaden sieves. It powders all the wood. It fills with alabaster wool the wrinkles of the road. It makes an even face of mountain and of plain, unbroken forehead from the east unto the east again. And that poem does remind us, I think it helps us experience our experience of winter in those first moments when we can scarcely believe how, you know, things have been leveled, that we're not level at all before. It helps us delight in the ornamental quality of the snow.
And she is, this is the Belle of Amherst, so is she talking there about Western Massachusetts, about Amherst?
Oh, I think she certainly is.
Yeah. This actually brings me to a piece that we're going to feature on our website by a Watertown poet that really, Eileen McCluskey, who writes about, really beautifully, about almost sort of the sexy snow. And that's probably not a term she would use, but I'm using it. James Scott, very briefly, your recommendation?
Hunters in the Snow by Tobias Wolff, another short story, another hunting short story, actually. Again, just exposing the sort of frailties of these characters and the sort of fragility of the world that that winters like this bring about. So it's another good one.
Excellent. Listeners, you can find links to the works that we've talked about today on our website, radioboston.org. You can still make recommendations as well. Lisa New, professor of American literature at Harvard, thank you.
Thank you.
James Scott, Massachusetts author of the novel The Kept, thank you as well, James.
Thanks so much.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Lisa Mullins. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston. Have a good weekend.